This week on the Best of Flashpoints, resistance to the coup in Honduras expands. We hear from one of many protests spilling into the streets of Tegucigalpa. Also, environmental justice activists take on Massey Energy, a coal mining operation responsible for devastating mountaintop removal. Investigative journalist Bob Perry talks about the unraveling humanitarian situation against the backdrop of elections in U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. Plus, Ali Abunima dissects Israeli and U.S. policy in the context of ongoing illegal settlement construction in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And Anthony Fenton blows the lid off of Canada's involvement in war profiteering in the colonial privatization of U.S.-occupied Iraq. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
This is Graham Russell with Rights Action, and I'm here with Karen Spring, who also works with Rights Action, and it's day 74 of the anti-coup pro-democracy resistance in Honduras. Rights Action's had the privilege of being here since the beginning. Different members of our staff have been able to get here. We've been supporting organizations, grassroots organizations, for over 10 years in Honduras, and a lot of the different struggles are coming together in this anti-coup pro-democracy struggle. And I've worked for many years in Central America mainly, going back 20 years, and this is an extraordinary popular movement. Central America's not seen anything like this before. At once it's a Honduran movement for real democracy, defense of the environment, etc. But it's also one more struggle of the Americas. And so there's similar struggles going on across the Americas, but it's now Honduras' turn. And what other citizens, quite a severe crackdown from the military regime from time to time, not every day. It seems like the military regime lets the protests go both in Tegucigalpa and across the country for days on end, sometimes for a week or two, and then they really wallop the people. So there's, since over the past 2 months, there's certainly been at least 10 people killed directly because of the repression, and then many wounded, seriously wounded or lightly wounded and gone to hospital. Hundreds have been illegally detained on trumped-up charges. Homes have been broken into, et cetera. I just came back. I was here for 3 weeks in July, and I've just come back for another short stay in the country, and this is my third march in a row. And I'm stunned and amazed by the energy of the population, and the movement's actually growing. And what they're doing now is they're taking the movement, it's been coordinated by what's called the National Front Against the Coup, but they're taking the movement to far-flung villages, far-flung regions of the country, and into the poor neighborhoods of Tegucigalpa and the big cities. Today, the march, which will last about 3 to 4 hours, snakes some 4 or 5 miles from the National University, which is in Tegucigalpa, up into the hills around the city and into the very poor neighborhoods. And what they're doing is they're calling the people out, and many people are joining in as we walk through the neighborhoods, and then many more are standing in the doors of the houses. Some just stand and stare. Some are just hooting and hollering and spurring the people on. And I think this is part of a calculated decision on the part of the National Front Against the Coup to take this movement to each and every neighborhood and let people take ownership of it. The National Front Against the Coup is an extraordinarily horizontal organization. It was founded by many grassroots indigenous organizations, unions, church groups, teachers organizations, etc. But it has not become a vertical structure, and they're taking all the right decisions to ensure that it does not become a vertical structure. And so across the country, people are taking personal ownership in the National Front. They're taking their guidance from it, but they're taking ownership of it. And so this pro-democracy movement is spreading out across the country, despite the ongoing poverty and then despite the waves of repression that come from time to time.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking to Graham Russell. He works with Rights Action. They are based in Canada and the United States, and they have kept a presence throughout this the long days of this coup. You are in a protest right now. Describe exactly what the protest looks like, what the signs say, what the chants sound like.
The Oh, I just got so enthused over the last couple of days, and we sent out to our listserv a couple of photo essays. But we're now on a dirt road in the, if anyone knows Tegucigalpa, it's a very hilly and mountainous city. And many of the poorest neighborhoods are on the steep hillsides, the barren and tree-covered hillsides on the edge of town. So we're way up on a hillside, and it looks called Suyapa. I don't know the city of Tegucigalpa that far in the crowd. But we're overlooking almost the entire city. So we're sort of way off in the distance. I can see the downtown towers of Tegucigalpa, where in the center of the town. And so we're walking through a fairly poor neighborhood, and the people are just lining the streets. And I pulled to do this topic, I pulled to the end of the march. I would say today that there's a couple thousand people in the march. I find it very hard to count numbers, but there's a huge number of people just walking along. They've got whistles and they've got noisemakers, and then there's a fellow walking beside me now, and I've seen him in other marches, and he has this puppet that he holds up on a stick, and it's of a gorilla. And that chant was Viva Narsalaya. Narsalaya is the deposed president who's still trying to get back into the country. And so a man in the march shouted it out to some family members who were staring out their door, and then they shouted it back. But the man with the puppet, he's at every march, and it's a puppet of a gorilla dressed up as a soldier, carrying money in one hand and a big a machine gun in the other hand. Because the expression here in Honduras for the army and the hierarchy of the army and the coup supporters is in guerrilletas. It's a play on the word gorilla. So that, and then there's tons of signs. So there's a sign up ahead that I saw yesterday in defense of Father Jose Tamayo. Father Tamayo is a Catholic priest who's been with the people for many years. He's Salvadoran born, but a nationalized Honduran. And then the illegal regime a few days ago unilaterally took an executive decision to take away his nationality. Now, of course, it's an illegal regime and they have no right to do that, but they've just gone ahead and done it because this is one of the priests that's in the streets with the people who's defended the environment and the human rights, et cetera, for many years. And he's a very outspoken defender of the people's rights. So now they want to kick him out of the country. The people are not going to allow it. He himself was in the march yesterday, surrounded by supporters, coming out in public and saying, this is my country and this is where I'll stay. There was some beautiful artwork yesterday that I saw, and it went out on our listserv today. There's some photos of it. People are doing artwork about the resistance and the repression, and the piece of artwork I photoed yesterday, took a photo of, was some man who put together a little display of how Yves Murillo was shot on July 5th. And this is one of the people that was shot by the military over the past 2 months, and he's become a bit of a, we call him a martyr of the popular struggle. And it was just so moving to see this man had done the artwork and now he's been just all the marches and shows it to people. And so in this way, and another favorite chant that the people are, and you see it on t-shirts and on spray painted on the walls, is they are afraid of us because we are not afraid of them, which is a very common phrase now in the popular movement, because it's quite apparent that the oligarchy and the military regimes have utterly miscalculated the strength and pride and dignity of their own people, and now they're afraid of this groundswell movement.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to the South and continue our focus on the fight against mountaintop removal and coal mining. On Wednesday morning, four protesters with Climate Ground Zero blocked the road to Massey Energy's regional headquarters in Boone County and were arrested along with a journalist covering the action. The protesters are charged with trespass, conspiracy, destruction of property, disobeying a lawful order, and resisting arrest. The four arrested activists, including an 81-year-old man and a 75-year-old man, comprise the human roadblock. The journalist was charged with trespass, failure to obey a lawful command, and conspiracy. According to a report by Climate Ground Zero, the four men used plastic pipes and chains to lock themselves together and to a guardrail and a light post, shutting down the road to the headquarters for early morning traffic. State troopers and Boone County sheriffs were on the scene soon after the lockdown, and bolt cutters arrived shortly thereafter. Police cut the chains binding the men to the guardrail and light post and dragged them to the side of the road by the pipes that still locked their arms together. Massey Energy is the company responsible for destructive coal mining operations, including wide-scale mountaintop removal. Joining us in one moment to talk about the actions and the arrests is Mike Rozelle. Mike is a co-founder of Earth First, the Rainforest Action Network, and the Ruckus Society. He's the author of the brand new book, Tree Spiker, From Earth First to Low Bagging, My Struggles in Radical Environmental Action. Mike has been with Climate Ground Zero in Appalachia, leading direct actions against the Massey Energy Company to prevent mountaintop removal at Coal River Mountain in West Virginia. We're now joined by Mike Rozell of Climate Ground Zero. Mike, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you, Nora.
So thank you. Talk a little more about what Climate Ground Zero did outside of Massey headquarters. And this followed a week-long tree sit to protest strip mining and mountaintop removal as well. Paint us a picture of the action and how Massey Energy and the local police responded.
Well, you know, this last Labor Day, Massey had a big concert in Logan on an old strip mine site called Friends of America, and it was very much a kind of a hate rally, a climate denial rally, and an attempt to really focus a lot of hatred on the people who have been trying to, you know, get some reform in the strip mining practices here in West Virginia. And this is pretty typical of Massey and their CEO, Don Blankenship. So after the Labor Day festival was over, we decided that we would go and demonstrate against Massey to try to put the attention back on the practices that they're involved in, which is blowing off the tops of mountains, dumping this debris into the creeks, and then dumping sludge and slurry and all these other toxic chemicals in an effort to, you know, get the coal out as cheaply as possible. So, you know, it was our way of kind of taking the fight to them. And as you said, there was four of them arrested, and one journalist was also arrested, and we're trying to get him out of jail right now. And it's been very difficult dealing with them. They have really large fines, really large bails, and we're trying to raise the money now to get them out.
That's the voice of Mike Rozell. We're talking about an action that happened early yesterday morning outside the headquarters of Massey Energy. And Mike, remind us, I know you've talked about this a lot on the show, but remind us a little bit about what Massey Energy does specifically with mountaintop removal strip mining.
Well, there's 50,000 acres of mountains have been clear cut here in West Virginia since this practice began. And then they are blown up with dynamite, you know, layer by layer. This is accomplished by drilling holes, packing them full of explosives, and then, you know, pushing off this overburden, they call it spoils or waste. It's very toxic because not only is it mixed with the residues from the explosives, but it contains a lot of hydrocarbons from the layers that are not really good enough to mine. And this is dumped in the creek, and so it elevates heavy metals and all kinds of other contaminants in the waters, and it's been poisoning people here ever since it's been done. And then the coal seams themselves are rarely over 20 or 30 inches deep. So there's several layers that just keep going down. Some of these mountains can lose as much as 1,300 feet of height during this process. And so this has been the most dramatic change in the landscape here in West Virginia of any industrial activity that's ever happened. And it's accelerating. Even under the Obama administration, it has not slowed down, even though they've said they're going to regulate it more. And so it's just people have been pretty fed up with this. They've run out of other ways to address this. We know we've tried going to court. We have legislation that we've tried to pass, but Massey doesn't obey the laws. They tend to control the media, and they almost own the courts. So this is about the only way that we have figured that we can stop it.
That's the voice of Mike Rozell of Climate Ground Zero. And Mike, can you talk about the tree sit that preceded the action yesterday? You know, when we envision a tree sit, it's usually in the middle of a dense old growth forest, but yours was a little different because it was directly inside of a strip mine area. Talk about what that looked like and what happened.
Well, the strip mining was going on above Petrie Bottom. And Petrie Bottom has a Petrie Creek in it, and there have been people living along this creek for 200 or 300 years. And the expansion of the mountaintop removal mine just over the ridge now had taken to the actual ridge above Petrie Bottom, and now for the first time visible from Route 3 or the Coal River. You know, most of these mines had been more remote. You know, tourists wouldn't see them as they drove through the state. So now it's kind of the ridge is being taken down that separates the river from the mine. And boulders and dust and stuff have been raining down on this area. The people who live there, you know, they're afraid to eat out of their gardens with the silica dust. And so the tree sitters went up to the trees just below where the mine was being expanded. There's a 600-foot zone that they have to have clear of any occupants in order for blasting to proceed, and they were about 300 feet from where the holes had been drilled and filled with dynamite. So they couldn't blast that day, and they couldn't get them out of the tree at first. And so for 7 days, there was no blasting above Petrie Bottom. That's the first time people can remember that happening this year. And there actually haven't been too much blasting up there since then. We're not really sure what's gone on up there, but in the past, after some of our actions, they actually have received some violations as the state and federal regulators, you know, finally do show up and look around. Up at Clay's Branch, where we had our first action, they still haven't done any more blasting up there for that very reason. So we don't really know what's going on up there. They don't let us go look around afterwards. But for 7 days, they weren't able to blast above Petrie Bottom, and that meant a lot to the folks that live below there, and we've really been talking to a lot of them, and they've been very thankful.
Mike Rozelle, as you said, it looks like the fight to end mountaintop removal won't be supported by the Obama White House, which has given the green light to coal companies like Massey to continue their destructive operations in Appalachia. What does this mean in terms of grassroots resistance groups like Climate Ground Zero? What are the next steps?
Well, we have legislation that may be brought up in this next session. And we've got a lot of sponsors, the Appalachian Restoration Act and the Clean Water Restoration Act. So this, I think Obama would have to assign this bill if it was passed, and we that would prevent any new permits. As far as the existing permits, you know, we can prevail in the court. You know, we do have the law on our side. These permits were all illegally granted. They are in violation of the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. So hopefully these big national groups that can afford attorneys will get more engaged and try to assert our legal rights. And then, you know, the third prong of our campaign is really education, you know, by alerting Americans to what's going on and waking their consciences and getting them involved. That really is the key to stopping this, because, you know, the only reason it's allowed to go on is because nobody pays attention what goes on in West Virginia. Nobody pays attention to where their coal comes from. They don't want to think about it when they turn on their light. And we think that if we can, you know, wake people up and educate them a little bit about the consequences, that, you know, we can get some reform, because we're really not going to have any kind of climate legislation that makes any sense unless we can, you know, really get some control over the burning of coal in this country. No. Well, I mean, if we can't end mountaintop removal, then we can't do anything about coal. And if we can't do anything about coal, then we can't really say that we're addressing the climate crisis. So this is why we think this is ground zero. It's a few of these coal state politicians that stand in the way of any kind of climate action and any kind of regulatory reform in the coal industry itself.
All right, Mike Rozelle, if people want to learn more, get educated, and find out more about mountaintop removal, where can they go?
Well, I would go to ilovemountains.org to find out what they can do to get involved in the bigger campaign and to keep abreast on the direct action campaign, the Climate Ground Zero campaign. Go to climateground0.org.
All right, that's the voice of Mike Rozelle of Climate Ground Zero. Again, that's climateground0.org and ilovemountains.org. Mike Rozelle, thank you for fighting the good fight, and we'll catch up with you very soon.
All right, thanks, Nora.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're joined by Robert Perry. He is the editor-founder of ConsortiumNews.com, an excellent source of alternative and excellent reporting on the net. Bob Perry, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. There are a couple of stories and issues you have raised, you and your writers on Consortium, that I wanted to follow up on. Interesting stories that certainly weren't fully reported and will be somewhat controversial to talk about. Let's start with Iran and the Iranian elections. The conventional wisdom in terms of what happened was the election was stolen, and the only way to remedy it is to have a new election. You raised some issues about whether it really was stolen, whether there is any kind of substantial proof that it was stolen. We know that it's a brutal government. We know that there's some severe problems in terms of human rights. But what do we know about the election being stolen?
Well, I think the story is much more mixed than has come across in the U.S. news media. And I think, again, what we're seeing is a bias against a country that, for reasons that are understandable, is considered essentially an enemy of the United States. And Ahmadinejad, the president, is considered a rather offensive character. That, all that being said, there's still this issue of really whether or not the election was the fraudulent thing that that the American press treats it as. The evidence on that is a lot thinner than people might think. And when this began to develop, I've been in many of those situations as a journalist for AP and Newsweek and PBS Frontline, of being parachuted into a country I knew very little about. And I always tried to resist the temptation of pretending or acting like I knew everything after having a few days of interviews and contacting a few of the various interest groups in the country. You really don't, and you should be much more humble about that, that things are more complicated, especially in countries where Americans have limited access, as in the case of Iran. And I have, by the way, spent time in Iran, but I, again, wouldn't pretend like I fully understand that country by any means. But I do think there was this a tendency of American journalists from the mainstream and on the left and right as well to jump to conclusions in support of the Mousavi forces because they were really more appealing. They were more like us in certain ways. And the Ahmadinejad supporters tended to be more conservative, poor. They were more rural or come from poor neighborhoods in the cities. So it's very hard in that situation, I think, for American journalists to know what happened because they're not really in touch with significant numbers of people from those groupings. So I think in that kind of case, journalists should be very skeptical about reaching conclusions. And in this case, the Mousavi forces began claiming fraud before any votes were counted. First, they claimed they had won before any votes were counted. And then when the initial votes came in saying that Ahmadinejad was ahead, which actually fit with some of the best polling that had been done prior to the election, there was a very good polling group involving Ken Ballen, a former a congressional aide who I've known, who had spent a great deal of time assessing the opinions across the country in May, which was a few weeks before the election, and found that Ahmadinejad was leading at roughly a 2-to-1 margin, which is where the votes turned out. So the issue becomes, was there this massive fraud? Was there this major swing first to Mousavi and then a fraud by Ahmadinejad's forces? And on that, we just really don't know. And regrettably, the efforts to have a recount, first there was an idea of a partial recount, and then there was even talk of a fuller recount. But that was rejected by the Mousavi forces who wanted instead a new election. And indeed, the New York Times had a lead editorial supporting Mousavi in that position, that there should not be a recount, there should be a new election. But the value of a recount is that you're able to then get real hard evidence of irregularities. If a bunch of ballots look like they're photostated, or if there's indications they're signed by the same person, or whatever you might have, and then I think you have a better case for fraud. As it turns out, the Mousavi people, when they put out their major claims about why they thought there was fraud, the case was not very strong at all. And in fact, part of it was that they claimed that Ahmadinejad's people had provided food to the poor as a way of getting them to vote for Ahmadinejad, that he had provided higher salaries for some of the people in the poor areas as a way to get them to vote for him. Well, in some ways, that's politics. Now, I suppose if you can show that it was directly tied, that you get a meal for voting for Ahmadinejad, maybe that's something. But that's not what they showed. What they showed was that Ahmadinejad was trying to do certain things with the poor communities to help them. And that was also in places like the Azeri community. One of the main points that the Mousavi supporters claimed was that since Mousavi comes from the Azeri section, he would naturally have gotten an overwhelming vote there. But Ken Ballen's, the polling that was done in May, showed that in the Azeri areas, Ahmadinejad was leading roughly 2-1 there. So one would assume that if the Azeris would simply plan to vote for Mousavi because he comes from that area, that would have been reflected in the May polling, as well as when they went to the elections on June 12th. So it just seems that many of the arguments that were being put forward about fraudulent elections were weak. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means I think it fell way short of being proven. But then there was this momentum of everybody in the Western press climbing on that bandwagon. And that can be a very dangerous phenomenon. And another quick point is that it's not irrational for the Iranians to think that there was an effort by the Americans and the British to achieve regime change in Iran. Not only that historically it happened in 1953 with the Mossadegh government, but we've known since the Clinton years that the U.S. policy was to have covert operations designed to achieve regime change in Iran. And those escalated in the 8 years of George W. Bush, and they haven't been called back by Barack Obama. So there have been these very costly efforts by the U.S. in particular, and with the help of the British and other allied intelligence services, to achieve that kind of change through some means or another. So it may not be true that the Mousavi people were reflecting that, but it's also not irrational for the Iranian government to suspect it.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are talking with Robert Perry. He is the founder, editor of ConsortiumNews.com, a longtime editor, reporter, working with some of the majors in Washington. Bob, I guess the real sticking point, and coming back to what you said, is that the opposition and the New York Times opposed a recount. And it really does raise the issue in terms of how much they wanted people to know about the election.
Right. As we saw in the United States in 2000, 2001, when there was finally a recount of the Florida ballots, which was carried out by a consortium of news organizations, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, et cetera, what the results were, what they showed was that Al Gore, if all the legally cast votes were counted, Al Gore won. Now, when that came out in November of 2001, after 9/11, the major papers tried to bury their own lead because they didn't want to report that the wrong guy was in the White House. But the evidence was there, and those of us who actually have gone over it, you could have found it on the 44th paragraph of those articles, or in the tabular material that accompanied them, that Al Gore was the legitimate winner in Florida and thus should have been president of the United States. So you can find things out from recounts. Now, obviously, in Iran, it's a bit different. You'd have to have some kind of safeguards. The opposition would have to have a fairly serious presence in the recount. But still, you would likely have found at least greater evidence of irregularities if indeed there had been massive fraud. Now, the fact that the Mousavi's people and the New York Times and other Western elements did not want a recount and instead were demanding a new election suggests to me they thought they would lose a recount. And one of the interesting dogs that hasn't barked here is that you're not really hearing from even the Western intelligence services about how they assess the election in Iran. And that's in part because what I've been hearing is that there's widespread belief in the analytical sections of the intelligence services in the West that Ahmadinejad did win. that they would agree with the analysis that the evidence is thin about massive fraud. But the political elements of the Western governments, you either because of the stampede by the press, their disdain for Ahmadinejad and other reasons, sort of jumped on the bandwagon for believing or alleging fraud. Although if you notice that many of the senior officials, even of the U.S. government, talked much less about fraud than they did about the repression of the demonstrations that followed the election. But the key question to me still comes back to, well, did Ahmadinejad win fairly in Iran or did he not? And if he did not, then that means one thing. But if he is the legitimately elected leader of Iran, whether we like him or not, whether we find his views offensive or not, that is still a significant point. Much like if Hamas won the elections in Palestine, that gives them a legitimacy that they wouldn't have if they simply had stolen the elections in Palestine. And even if you don't like somebody, the fact that they have, under our democratic principles, that they won, that gives them a certain level of seriousness that they should be dealt with.
And, you know, Baba, this just comes to mind as you're talking, you know, like versus not like, legitimate election versus illegitimate election. It seems that the United States government protested more about the alleged steal in Iran than the clear-cut military coup in Honduras.
Right. That is interesting because Honduras is obviously closer to the United States. Honduras and the United States have a long history, not a very pleasant one, going back centuries, where the U.S. has been involved in various ways in Honduran politics. So it is striking that while the Iran elections became front page news literally for days and weeks, the Honduran coup, which was an overthrow of an elected government, was treated pretty much as an inside the paper story almost from the beginning and has gotten very little attention relative to what was given to the Iranian election. I think in part that is that, again, it reflects a certain bias on the part of the top editors of the U.S. news organizations who were almost unanimously disdainful of Ahmadinejad, and they were not friendly towards Zelaya. They saw Zelaya as an ally or someone similar, having some ties to Chavez in Venezuela. And connected to other more leftist-oriented populist leaders that are now emerging in Latin America. So there was this disdain for him, much like we saw with Aristide in Haiti when I was covering that back in the early 90s. There was the sense that, yes, Aristide clearly was the legitimately elected leader of Haiti. He was overwhelmingly elected, but he was sort of a leftist. He had sort of populist positions. He criticized the United States and its behavior in the region. So when he was overthrown by Cedras and the military back a couple decades ago, there was very little interest in restoring him to power. It took years, and finally Bill Clinton did force that. But then Aristide was left in a kind of a almost in semi house arrest. The way that was worked, it was. He was under extreme protection, really wasn't allowed to carry out his policies and so forth. But we see something similar happening in Honduras, where the U.S. has not pushed very aggressively to reverse the coup. It looks like it's just going to continue as sort of a status quo until the elections in November. And now Zelaya, as you know, has been trying to get the United States and other nations in the region to refuse to recognize an election carried out under those kinds of circumstances. But the United States so far has not been very tough or aggressive, and that's a case where clearly the popular will as expressed through a legitimate election has been overturned. It's a much more black and white case than anything we've seen in Iran, where there's a strong argument that Ahmadinejad really would have won whether or not there was some fraud or not. Yet that's been a case where the United States has weighed in much more aggressively, and the American press has made a much bigger deal of it than they have Honduras.
talk about the current settlement situation in occupied Palestine is Ali Abunima. Ali is the editor and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. He joins us from Jordan. Ali, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Ali, let's begin by having you lay out the history of settlement expansion as a policy in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and how this recent move by Netanyahu fits into the story.
Well, the settlements began more than 40 years ago in 1968, just months after Israel occupied the West Bank, and have continued ever since. But the period of fastest growth of settlements has been during the so-called peace process. So, ironically, the more intense the focus on peace, the more Israel concentrates on confiscating Palestinian land to build Jewish-only settlements and to make sure that there is little or no land left to return to Palestinians. And that has been the consistent pattern of the past few years. And, I mean, it's sort of a very simple analogy. If you go with the idea of a two-state solution, of the partition of the land, just imagine you're talking about a pizza, and you're going to decide how to divide it between two people, and you say we're going to negotiate on, you know, where to slice it and who gets what and who likes anchovies and who likes olives and so on. And during the negotiations, one of the people starts to scoff the pizza and eat it as fast as possible. Obviously, in those circumstances, negotiations don't make any sense whatsoever. And so that's the logic behind the demand that Israel freeze settlements during the so-called peace negotiations. And to that extent, the demand is not only a demand for Israel to comply with international law and stop stealing other people's land, but makes sense in the context of a peace process.
That's the voice of our good friend Ali Abunima of the Electronic Intifada. And Ali, what about the legalities here? Even if there's no new growth, in a best-case scenario in Obama's eyes, if Israel doesn't build these settlements, the settlements themselves, wherever they are, however big or small they are, the ones that exist right now, are all illegal. What's being done about challenging the U.S. administration and Israel on the core of this issue?
Right. That's where the language that's being used and the shifting focus is so important to understand because, as you said, under international law, all the Israeli settlements are illegal. Every single Israeli civilian placed over the 1967 line is there in violation of international law. And international law is very, very clear on this. It's not in dispute anywhere. The Fourth Geneva Convention states in Article 49 that the occupying power shall not transfer parts of its civilian population into the territory it occupies. That has been universally understood by the international community to render these settlements totally illegal. And if that's been in any doubt, then over the decades, the UN Security Council passed numerous resolutions stating clearly and unambiguously that all the settlements are illegal and must be removed. Not just that, you know, building them is illegal, but that each day that they remain on occupied Palestinian land constitutes an additional crime. This was confirmed in 2004 by the International Court of Justice ruling, which on the Israel's West Bank apartheid wall, which also confirmed the illegality of the settlements. But what's at issue now is, you know, when Obama came into office and everyone said, look, you know, Obama's talking really tough and this is going to be different from Bush, and he demanded a complete freeze to settlements, and Hillary Clinton went out, the Secretary of State, and said, you know, a freeze means a freeze. It means no natural growth, no nothing. What we've come to today is that after 8 months of back and forth of negotiations between Israel and the Obama administration, basically the Obama administration has abandoned the call for Israel to freeze the settlements. It has resorted to the kind of mealy-mouthed language which we got from all of its predecessors. And Israel is talking about, okay, you know, Obama reduced the demand from a full freeze to a 12-month pause. Israel countered with, you know, we'll have a 6 to 9 month pause, but that excludes East Jerusalem. Most of the settlement construction is in and around East Jerusalem. So right there, you've excluded most of the settlements from the freeze. And then we're going to exclude 2,500 homes that we've already approved. And then we're going to approve additional homes, as you pointed out in the introduction, in advance of any freeze, so that during the 6 to 9 months that Israel would be adhering to the so-called freeze, that they would be proceeding with construction of up to 3,000 settler homes. Well, in an average year, according to Haaretz, Israel builds roughly around 2,000 settler homes. So during the period of the so-called freeze, what I'm calling the Obama freeze, Israel would be actually building settlements at a faster pace than in an average year. And what is notable about the Obama administration's statement of regret about Israel's latest announcement of the additional settlements is they said, we challenge or we oppose, I'm paraphrasing, but the key point is the legitimacy of continued expansion. So the United States is only contesting continued expansion, and the subtext there is that the U.S. is not contesting the hundreds of thousands of settlers who are already in the West Bank, the vast destruction that the existing settlements have done to Palestinian lives and Palestinian rights. Those are not at issue. We're only talking about now, we were not even a freeze, but what the White House called limitations on settlement construction. That's what happened from the tough talk of 8 months ago to now, where we're at sort of sub-Bush language on the settlement.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Though the United States continues its large-scale occupation of Iraq as Obama extends the contracts of private mercenary companies such as Blackwater and DynCorp, it is not the only North American country profiting off the death and destruction of Iraq. According to a new article by Canadian investigative journalist Anthony Fenton, the Canadian private military industry, protected by its oil companies and security firms, works directly with the U.S. military and its Western allies in the occupation of Iraq. Joining us to talk about all of this is Anthony Fenton. His new article, Hostile Takeover, Canada's Outsourced War for Iraq's Oil Riches, was published online at this.org. Anthony, as I mentioned, is a Canadian investigative journalist and is the co-author of Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority. Anthony, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Nora.
So let's get right into this. Lay out the scope of Canada's involvement with the current U.S. occupation of Iraq and its historical role in the destabilization of the country. As in, you know, did Canada jump on the Western military-industrial bandwagon after the U.S. started the 2003 occupation, or was it already involved way before then during the sanctions, for example? Give us a sense of Canada's historic and current role in Iraq.
Absolutely. Well, you hit the nail on the head there, right there. There is an historical role, and even though most Canadians and definitely few people within your audience will be aware that Canada was an active participant in the war in the early 1990s in Iraq, and then was one of the main countries alongside the U.S. and the U.K. in imposing the brutal genocidal sanctions on the Iraqi people throughout the 1990s. But when it came time to the drumbeat leading up to the war in 2002 and 2003, Canada was equivocated, and in the last minute, literally a few days before the U.S. and U.K. launched the invasion, Canada's Parliament and Canada's Prime Minister at the time was Jean Chrétien, famously got up and declared that Canada would not participate in the war. But unfortunately, as many commentators, many scholars have noted since then, this is actually a hypocritical statement. In fact, Canada did, in many ways, in fact, more so than many of the countries that were officially part of the Coalition of the Willing, Canada did help support the war and invasion of Iraq. And you can list off the ways that they did so by allowing U.S. Airplanes to fly through Canadian airspace en route to the Middle East by having Canadian soldiers embedded with U.S. and U.K. Troops on the ground in Iraq, by having Canadian military planners out of the Central Command in Florida moving to Qatar in the days before the invasion and continuing to help plan the invasion itself, and in many, many other ways. And another area that Canada has been involved in Iraq that's important to this, to the question we're discussing today, is the fact that for a long time, Canada has been one of the top importers of Iraqi oil. And that's kind of a paradoxical situation, because Canada is the largest supplier of oil to the United States. And because Canada is the largest supplier of oil to the United States and sends so much of its oil to the U.S., it doesn't send oil to the eastern part of Canada. And Canada, the eastern part of Canada, is dependent, as we hear this term, dependent on foreign oil. Well, Canada is very dependent on foreign oil as well as the U.S., and a lot of it comes from Iraq. And so, Canada has had deepening economic ties, not just in Iraq, but in the broader Middle East region, increasingly, since the end of the Cold War, and as we've seen the emergence of this, global capitalism and so forth. And so one of the ways that Canada really benefited from the whole Iraq War, and of course we have at the same time the other front of the so-called global war on terror, is the war in Afghanistan. Now, Canada was quick to join that war in 2001 because it was seen as the good war, and it was politically palatable for Canada to join the Afghan war in 2001. And one of the things they did right before saying that they wouldn't join, quote-unquote, wouldn't join the war in Iraq, was they publicly said that they would commit to putting soldiers into Afghanistan. This is back in 2003. And interestingly enough, just a couple of years ago, a best-selling book came out about sort of an insider account about the decisions that led to Canada's role now in the heart of the Afghan insurgency in southern Afghanistan, called The Unexpected War. And there was a chapter in that book that detailed the decision to stay out of Iraq. And in that book, they quoted Canada's former defense minister, who said that he had a meeting with Donald Rumsfeld in January 2003, and Rumsfeld himself said, we don't even want Canadian soldiers in Iraq. We want them in Afghanistan to what they call backfill U.S. soldiers, sort of like it's a fungibility of war where, Canadian support in Afghanistan can really help U.S. Soldiers in Iraq. And so this whole exercise of Canada not going to Iraq was really a public relations exercise. And so after the fact, after the invasion took place in 2003, with a legitimate Canada who took this, seemingly moral stand not invading Iraq, was able to have more legitimacy when they went to the table and called for the so-called reconstruction of Iraq, and said, so Canada was the first country, one of the first countries to step forward after George Bush announced mission accomplished in May of 2003, that we would step forward and we would help police train Iraqi police, we would help build Iraqi democracy, and took part in this so-called freedom agenda of George Bush in Iraq. And this is all very quiet, because at the time, the opposition, and there was overwhelming opposition within Canada domestically to Canadian role in the war, well, that deflated after the very public decision not to join. And so when the involvement of Canada, the real world actual involvement of Canada in Iraq after the war began, the Canadian movement, the progressives who were mobilizing against the war, were more or less demobilized. And so there's been this quiet, intensifying Canadian role within Iraq in many different areas over the years. Here we are 6 years later, and it's all been very much under the radar. And so there's been very little attention to it, and I've been investigating it. And of course, one of the areas that we find the most the deepest Canadian involvement is not militarily so much. It's on the corporate side. It's on the private military contractors. It's on the armored vehicle manufacturers who send over thousands of armored vehicles to protect the private mercenary firms that are in Iraq, that are basically providing over half of the occupation itself. And then the Canadian oil and gas companies. Today on my website, I just put up a list of 15 Canadian companies that either have contracts with Baghdad or with the Kurdistan regional government, or have pursued contracts, or like an oil support firm, like a geophysical or type of firm that's helping do the exploration and the seismic work and so forth. And so we're seeing the emergence of what I call in the article this mercenary military sort of mini mercenary industrial complex that Canada is providing to the war effort there. And so it's quite disturbing on one level, especially given that so little attention has been paid to it. But it's also really indicative. There was this article in the Globe and Mail, in the business section. That's where, sort of like the old adage that I think Noam Chomsky said, if you really want to see what's going on in the world, you just read the business press. And that's the case when it comes to Canada's role in Iraq. So one of the articles focused on these Canadian oil companies that are active there. And they noted that the U.S. has specifically had a sort of a hands-off policy when it comes to US, supporting U.S. oil companies that are going into Iraq, and they've been allowing countries like Canada to step forward and get these contracts because, as we're seeing now, the smaller companies that have been early into the game to secure these very lucrative, and we're talking billions of dollars in profits that are going to be going into the coffers of these corporations. The smaller companies go in, secure the contracts, and then come the bigger companies to buy out the smaller companies. And so I'm sure that factors into it. And you have this this relationship between Canada and the U.S. And it's no wonder when you see that the Canadian-U.S. militaries, there are no two militaries in the world that are closer or more deeply integrated. And then it comes as no surprise when you really understand this, and you sort of have no illusions about what Canada's role really is in the world. And you understand that these types of contracts are just—it's perfectly commonsensical that Canadians would benefit from the opening up of Iraq's oil fields to foreign companies.
That's the voice of Anthony Fenton. He's an investigative journalist in Canada, and his website is webofdemocracy.org. And let's illustrate this point a little further about these private companies that are amassing extreme, egregious amounts of profits through the U.S. Occupation of Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about Skylink Aviation for a moment, just as an example of a Canadian company that is raking in billions of dollars?
Oh, exactly. They're probably, I describe them as probably the most profitable of and most unknown of all the Canadian companies that are operating in post-war Iraq. In fact, they were earliest in the game. They're based out of Toronto, and they have a global network of affiliate companies, you could say front companies, that they create. So they have Skylink Aviation headquarters in Toronto, and in Iraq they'll have a company called Skylink Arabia, and then they'll have another. They have another one based in the U.S. called Skylink USA, and so their tentacles reach, and they're very difficult to track down. Of course, as many private companies are, they're very secretive, so it's very difficult to get concrete information and details about their activities. But from what I've been able to piece together, they basically went into Iraq immediately after the invasion. They secured a contract from USAID, I believe, to secure the Iraqi airport, so Baghdad International Airport. Basically became Skylink International Airport. They ran, all the cargo incoming and outgoing from this airport, and they also got contracts for other airports. And once they established that foothold, and I think that was a $17 million contract they ended up being in, once they established that foothold, they started branching out into other areas. They joined these private mercenary coalitions like the Private Security Contractors of Iraq, and they got in cozy with the former U.S. Army colonel, I believe it was, who was basically running and doling out all of the reconstruction contracts. And so they're really, really involved in this sort of cycle of corruption, as it's detailed in books like Pratap Chatterjee's Iraq Inc. or his more recent book Halliburton's Army. And really, this is sort of like Canada's extension to Halliburton's Army, because they are very much inextricable. So, for example, Skylink's one of their bigger contracts, they got a $10 million contract to ferry and transport around all of the Kellogg Brown and Root, or not, as it's now known, KBR, employees in and out and around Iraq. They also got a contract to transport Blackwater personnel. In fact, one of their airplanes that they're using to transport Blackwater personnel was shot down several years ago. And, you know, these are the instances when we see Skylink appear in the media, make a rare appearances when one of their airplanes are shot down or helicopters, as has happened recently in Afghanistan as well. And so they're really what they are, and they say it themselves in their literature. They provide mission-critical work to the occupation, to the counterinsurgency war. And the amazing thing is that if you look at the media representation of Skylink in Canada or anywhere, they go to pains, to great lengths, to project an image of being a sort of a private humanitarian aid organization, when in reality, you know, they've been profiting, like so many of these private companies, off of a brutal war and occupation in Iraq. And there's an interesting side story to this. In fact, a source of considerable amount of information on Skylink's background was another private contractor by the name of Richard Galustian. Has filed a lawsuit against Skylink because he feels he's been cheated from a stake in the Skylink Arabia company that he had been promised. And in his record of motion to the courts in Toronto, and this is something that hasn't even been reported in the Canadian media yet, in his motion of record, he lists all these details about, you know, $100 million in profits over a 2 or 3 year period for Skylink in Iraq, and just all this corruption, trying to cut him out of the deal by creating a fake Iraqi arrest warrant and circulating it amongst the private mercenary community in order to sully his name and get him out of there. And it's interesting because, you know, this image that Skylink projects of itself, they said, and I mentioned in the article, how one of the owners of the company basically says, "We're in Canada. We're located, our head office is located in Canada because it's like Switzerland. You know, it's viewed as this peacekeeping nation." And the owner, this is the owner, Walter Arbib, I believe. He's an Israeli-Canadian. And he basically says, like, look, if we were in Israel, what, you know, how would we be perceived if we were going into a country like Iraq and doing business? Well, it wouldn't be sustainable in terms of a public relations standpoint. So let's go to Canada and have our headquarters there, because there's this great myth there of Canada the peacekeeper. And so that sort of sums up Skylink Aviation. I hope to see some, you know, mainstream journalists attacking this story, because, you know, with limited means, independent journalists who quickly get stonewalled by these public relations representatives can't really dig up too much else on them.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.